Welcome back. In the previous lecture, we saw how Rome, in various parts of the Greek-speaking world, demonstrated once and for all that she was no longer prepared to tolerate any challenge to her power. In this lecture, we're going to be covering the period following the destruction of Corinth in 146 BC to Octavian's victory over Mark Antony and Cleopatra at the Battle of Actium in 31 BC, a period of just over a century. You'll recall that following the death of Alexander the Great in 323 BC, his empire was divided up into three main blocks: Macedon, ruled by the Antigonid dynasty; Syria, Mesopotamia, ruled by the Seleucid dynasty; and Egypt, ruled by the Ptolemaic dynasty. We've already seen that the Antigonid dynasty was abolished in 168 BC when Macedon was divided up into four republics. That wasn't until 146 that it was reduced to the status of a Roman province. That left the Seleucids and the Ptolemies still in place, though both of them were by now under the sway of Rome. In this lecture, we're going to be focusing on four specific regions. First, Pergamum, a kingdom in northwest Turkey. Second, the Pontic region, the territory bounded by the southern coastline of the Black Sea. Third, the Seleucid Empire, or what remained of it, and fourth, Egypt. Throughout the period from 146 to 31 BC, Rome was in effect involved in a kind of mopping up operation as she extended her grasp over the remaining parts of the Greek-speaking world that still retained pretensions to autonomy. Even so, each of the four regions teaches us something very important in terms of their relationship with the Romans. I'm going to be referring to the rulers who succumbed to Rome in this period as dynasts, because all of them had pretensions to regional power. They had certainly been true of Philip V of Macedon and of his son Perseus, both of whom had expansionist ambitions that brought them into conflict with Rome. The dynasts we're going to be talking about did not govern territories with well-defined borders. There were no such things as well-defined borders in antiquity. The Seleucid Empire, at one point, stretched from Thrace in the west to the borders of India in the east. The dynasts were constantly jockeying for power, first with each other, and then later with Rome, as we saw in the previous lecture in the case of Antiochus IV laying claim to Egypt. This helps to explain why the Romans were so nervous of Hellenistic dynasty. Not for nothing, many of them minted coins with the head of Alexander the Great on the obverse, showing that they had very big ambitions altogether. Let's begin by talking about the origins of monarchy in the Greek world. Though Hellenistic monarchy was an institution unto itself, its roots were very ancient as Homer. In the Iliad, Agamemnon, the commander-in-chief of the Greek army, is acknowledged to be king of kings. That's to say, he exercises over lordship over all the other kings, such as Nestor, Odysseus, Diomedes, and Ajax, though they are not entirely subject to him. Achilles, for instance, who is himself a king, threatens to return to Greece with his contingent of Myrmidons and would, it seems, be within his rights to do so. Kingship was undoubtedly favoured by many Greek states before they evolved into aristocracies, oligarchies, and democracies. Athens, for instance, preserved the tradition that she was once ruled by kings, and the retention of the name Basileus, meaning king, for one of her magistracies, confirms the truth of that tradition. And though the overwhelming majority of Greek communities adopted some form of popular representation, kingship certainly didn't die out. Sparta, for instance, had a dual kingship, two hereditary monarchs deriving from two different royal houses, each exercising equal power. And in the 4th century BC, kingship in the Greek world even staged something of a comeback. Thessaly in central Greece, Syracuse in Sicily, Caria on the western coast of Turkey, and most important of all, Macedon in northern Greece were all monarchies. Nor was monarchy regarded as outmoded by political theorists. Plato, for one, justified monarchy as an enlightened form of government, as I'll talk about in a moment. And in the 4th century, it became the most powerful and effective governmental system. It was Philip II, father of Alexander the Great, who had demonstrated to the Greek city-states that they were no match for Macedon. Precisely why Macedon became so successful in the second half of the 4th century BC is a complete mystery. Army reforms, urbanization, these probably contributed to it. Much, no doubt, depended on the charisma of its kings, however. First, Philip II, and then, unlike anything the world has seen before or since in terms of charisma, Alexander the Great. Kingship, then, was a combination of legitimized authority and a particular style of personal leadership. Just a word about Roman monarchy. Roman kings seem to have been chosen more on their merits than just being descended one from another. The Hellenistic dynasts who came to power in the wake of the breakup of Alexander's empire were, however, a rather different breed from any that had existed previously. Most important, they sought to present themselves as enlightened despots. Plato, in The Republic, talks famously about the philosopher king as the ideal. And though no Hellenistic dynast quite lived up to that, many did seek to present themselves, perhaps the better term is market themselves, as exhibiting love of their subjects. The Greek word is philanthropia, our word philanthropy, and beneficence, good actions. The Greek word is euergesia, both of which typically manifest themselves in public works and the like. To what extent the kings actually lived up to this ideal is questionable, but the ideal at least helped to prevent them from indulging in the worst excesses of monarchical abuse. And as we'll see later, Hellenistic monarchy is enormously important for our investigation because it provided the blueprint for the Augustan Principate, a form of government which was based on the claim that the emperor A exhibited self-control, courage, wisdom, and so forth, and B was a generous benefactor to his people. Another important feature of Hellenistic monarchy was its religious aspect. Many of the kings adopted a divine protector. Heracles in the case of the Antigonids, Apollo in the case of the Seleucids, and Dionysus in the case of the Ptolemies, in order to give legitimacy to their claims. That's because, in origin, all the first generation of Hellenistic kings were usurpers. And when the Romans came into contact with these monarchies, it became logical to adopt the same tactic. In the eventual showdown between Octavian and Mark Antony, Octavian appropriated the sponsorship of Apollo, and Mark Antony that of Dionysus. Dionysus was a logical choice for one who had allied himself to the Egyptian monarchy, though it was also a somewhat unfortunate choice since Dionysus was associated with overindulgence. Having adopted a divine protector, the next step along the line was to claim to be a god oneself, to introduce, therefore, what scholars call ruler cult. Initially, only dead kings were deified. Later, living kings and their wives were deified as well. The pioneer in this movement was Ptolemy I of Egypt, who established a cult of Alexander the Great in Alexandria. And when Ptolemy I died, his son, Ptolemy II, deified him. Then, in the 260s, Ptolemy II set up a cult of the Theoi Adelphoi, the brother-sister gods, for himself and his sister queen, Arsinoe, in their lifetimes. The Ptolemies and some of their subjects adopted the pharaonic practice of brother-sister marriage. And other monarchies quickly followed suit in deifying their kings. Hellenistic monarchy was the form of government in the Greek-speaking world with which the Romans primarily dealt. They also had to deal with the Greek city-states on an individual basis and in the form of federated leagues, but their most important interaction was with the dynasts. And the fact that the Greek-speaking world favoured monarchy set up an awkward tension from the start between the Greeks and the Romans. That's because one of the most important events in Roman history was the expulsion of the last king, Tarquinius Superbus, Tarquin the Proud, and the establishment of the Republic in its place. Ever afterwards, the Romans were deeply suspicious of the institution, exhibited a strong aversion to the word rex, meaning king, and prided themselves on having liberated themselves from the shackles of monarchy. Even so, despite their ideological objection to the institution, the Romans continued to have a highly ambivalent relationship with monarchy. In the first century BC, for instance, powerful Roman politicians and generals, men like Pompey the Great and Julius Caesar, started to behave like dynasts themselves once they were away from Rome. And in so doing, they put enormous strains on the republican system. It was the fear that Julius Caesar was contemplating setting himself up as a king that led directly to his assassination. And when Octavian, after defeating Mark Antony, found himself unchallenged, he was very careful to avoid giving any suspicion that he was in effect establishing a monarchy, although that's precisely what he did establish in effect. Even so, it's a fair assumption that the average Roman in the street would have regarded with faint scorn a people or peoples who favoured monarchy, though after half a century of civil war, they eventually came to appreciate the virtues of a centralised system of decision-making for the running of their complex, heterogeneous, and somewhat unwieldy empire, and so they embraced the Augustan Principate. The first of the four Hellenistic dynasties I want to talk about is Pergamum. I'll be talking about the city of Pergamum in a later lecture. What I want to focus on here is its dynasty, the Attalid dynasty, in fact. Attalid comes from Attalus, which was a commonly chosen name for its kings. And under their rule, Pergamum became one of the most important Hellenistic cities in terms of its wealth, its culture, and its influence. The extraordinary thing about the Attalids is that they came out of nowhere. The founder of the dynasty was a man called Philetyrus, an opportunist if ever there was one. Philetyrus just so happened to be left in charge of a treasure chest by one of Alexander the Great's generals, Lysimachus, when he went off to fight against Seleucus I, Nicator, in around 300 BC. When Lysimachus opportunely died in battle, Philetyrus found he had the tidy sum of 9,000 talents at his disposal. Well, what do you do with 9,000 talents? The obvious thing to do is to call yourself a king and get a bit of land to rule, which is exactly what Philetyrus did, calling himself king, not just of Pergamum, but also of a large chunk of Western Turkey. And the next thing you do, if the opportunity presents itself, is to claim to be the fearless defender of Greek civilization against the barbarians, which is exactly what Philetyrus also did. In 278, he defended Pergamum from the Galatians, a Celtic people related to the Gauls who crossed the Hellespont, which made the credentials of the Attalids second to none, not least because Pergamum could now insert its name into the list of those cities who had warded off the barbarians. It's fair to say that all the Attalids were accomplished self-promoters, and it's also fair to say that Pergamum and the Pergamenes came out of it very nicely as well, thank you. Before the Attalids came to power, Pergamum was already organised on Greek lines. It now shot to cultural prominence, with a library to rival the one at Alexandria. It also had what is arguably the greatest example of Hellenistic art and architecture ever executed, the spectacular Great Altar of Zeus, erected sometime after 188 BC. We'll be talking about it in a later lecture. It reeks with propaganda advertising the military achievements of Pergamum. Then, around 150 BC, Attalus II paid for the construction of the famous marble stoa that bears his name in the Agora at Athens, a very nice example of philanthropia. A stoa, by the way, is a multi-purpose building with a colonnade below and rooms above. The Stoa of Attalus, which was reconstructed by the American School of Classical Studies in Athens in 1953-6 to house its finds from the excavation of the Agora, is arguably the best example of a fully developed Stoa from anywhere in the Greek-speaking world. It was a great way to get noticed, since Athens, despite her political unimportance at this date, even her eclipse, still remained a cultural mecca and would do so virtually throughout antiquity. We'll be discussing Athens at some length later as well. Then, in 133 BC, Attalus III died, apparently bequeathing his kingdom to the Romans. We don't exactly know why he did this. It may have been to avert social unrest in his kingdom. As a result, his royal lands now became the property of the Roman people, while the cities that he had controlled became autonomous and freed from tribute. His kingdom, which, as I said, included a large chunk of western Turkey, officially became known as Provincia Asia. Though the population of the province of Asia was by no means exclusively Greek in ethnicity, Greek was spoken throughout its entirety. Well, the Romans quickly realized how wealthy the province was and began to exploit it ruthlessly nonetheless. It was so wealthy, in fact, that many thousands of Roman and Italian businessmen settled in, eager to make their fortunes there. In fact, it may have been the acquisition of this province that made the Romans finally realize that their empire could be a source of considerable enrichment to them. As a result of their rapacity, they sowed widespread hatred among the local population. And this is where we come to the next chapter in our story. This hatred eventually boiled over into open rebellion when in 89 BC, Nicomedes IV, king of a region named Bithynia, made an incursion into the territory of Mithridates VI, Eupator, king of Pontus. Bithynia and Pontus had both been carved out of the Seleucid Empire in 190 BC. They were situated on the south coast of the Black Sea. Bithynia lay to the west, Pontus to the east. Pontus is actually the Greek word meaning sea. Nicomedes was following a directive from the Romans who wanted to provoke war between the two kingdoms with the objective of reducing them both. Whether he actually realized he was being set up by the Romans isn't recorded, but he anyway had no choice. Mithridates responded by taking the bold step of invading the Roman province of Asia, posing as the liberator of all Greeks under Roman domination. Many, many Greeks threw their support behind him. Their hatred for the Romans was such that when he ordered them to massacre the Romans and Italians who were resident in Asia, they complied. The figure is almost certainly exaggerated, but it's said that 80,000 Romans and Italians were massacred in one night. And more than anything, this tells us how the Romans had made themselves thoroughly unpopular in the 40 years they'd been ruling the province. Appian, a Greek who was born in Alexandria at the end of the 1st century AD, gives us a chilling account of the atrocities that Greeks belonging to different Asiatic cities committed against the Romans. He says, the Ephesians tore away the fugitives who had taken refuge in the sanctuary of Artemis and who were clasping the statues of the goddess, and they cut them down. The Pergamenes shot with arrows those who had fled to the sanctuary of Aesculapius, not removing them from the statues to which they were clinging, and so on. It's striking that this testimony comes to us from a Romanized Greek because it paints such a horrific picture of Greek barbarism. Shortly afterwards, an opportunity presented itself to Mithridates to involve himself in the affairs of mainland Greece. This came about when the Democratic Party in Athens invited him to liberate the mainland from Roman rule. Mithridates sent a naval expedition to the Piraeus, the port of Athens, intending to use it as a base for his operations. Athens had long-standing ties of friendship with Pontus and felt herself more or less constrained to support Mithridates. Then Lucius Cornelius Sulla, one of Rome's hard men, was put in charge of the war. Early in 87 BC, Sulla landed at Epirus with 5 legions and marched south to Athens. In the spring of 86, he managed to starve the city into submission. Furious at the obstinacy of the defenders, he ordered a general massacre. Halfway through, however, yielding to the appeal of Athenian exiles and Roman senators in his train, he called it off, allegedly out of respect for Athens' glorious past. He subsequently congratulated himself for this act of quote-unquote generosity by assuming the cognomen or honorary title Thalix, meaning fortunate or blessed. Athens did not, however, get off scot-free. Some of the buildings in the Agora were destroyed and the Odeon of Pericles, which stood beside the Theatre of Dionysus, was burned down. Sulla also gave orders to his men to strip a lot of architectural bits and pieces that took his fancy back to Rome, including columns from the great temple of Zeus Olympius. They would be reused to grace the temple of Jupiter Optimus Maximus on the Capitol. It was the Piraeus, however, which bore the brunt of his rage. Partly because its inhabitants put up a more spirited resistance, the port city was utterly destroyed. Mithridates' lieutenant, Archelaus, was finally defeated by Sulla to the north of Athens in Boeotia. Appian claims that numerous massacres occurred in the aftermath to the Mithridatic War and that the walls of many Greek cities were demolished. Others were plundered and their citizens sold into slavery. We've no idea of knowing how many Greeks, free and slaves, lost their lives in the war, but it was certainly in the tens, if not the hundreds of thousands. In exacting reprisals from the Greeks, the Romans weren't any less barbaric than the Greeks had been in their initial assault upon the Romans. It's probably no exaggeration to state that the Greek-speaking world experienced more destruction of life and property in the 2 years or so that Sulla was in the region than it did at any other period of history, ancient or modern. We don't know in detail the long-term effects of these wars on the region, but we do know that they were devastating. Economic decline coupled with depopulation was undoubtedly widespread throughout mainland Greece. In 45 BC, a friend of Cicero called Servius Sulpicius Rufus wrote what amounts to a judgment upon Roman military intervention in mainland Greece. He writes, "At sea, on my way back from Asia, I was looking at the shores around about. Astern lay Aegina, before me lay Megara, on my right the Piraeus, and on my left Corinth, all once teeming cities, and now lying ruined and wrecked before our eyes." Sulla eventually made peace with Mithridates, probably in the autumn of 85 BC, on his own terms and without consulting the Senate. The bitterness and the hostility towards the Romans on the part of the Greeks must have been visceral. It was not, of course, the end of the story. 40 years later, Julius Caesar planted colonies in the mainland for his veterans. His example was to be followed by the Emperor Augustus a bit later, bringing the total to about 10 in all. One of the most important of these new colonies was Corinth, refounded by Caesar in 44. Though the planning of colonies amounts to the forcible appropriation of land by the imperial power, we have to concede that over time this development brought about a degree of economic revival in the region. Ultimately too, and perhaps from early on, these new colonies became the home of Greek speakers, so that Romans and Greeks actually found themselves living side by side. But the fate of Greece from the first century AD onwards is a topic we must reserve for later. It was in the late first century BC that the process that we call Hellenization, the influence of Greek culture on Roman culture, gained ground in all areas. Virtually no aspect of Roman life or Roman thinking remained untouched. Religion, art, architecture, literature, science, medicine, philosophy, education, even sexual norms, all were transformed as a result, as we will see in later lectures devoted to the various aspects of this subject. And now that Greek culture had permeated all aspects of Roman culture, it would become a feature of its landscape to the end of antiquity and beyond. A word next about the Seleucid Empire of Syria-Mesopotamia. In 188 BC, as we saw earlier, the Romans had forced Antiochus III to give up his kingdom north of the Taurus Mountains in Turkey and to stay out of what we would call Europe. But he still retained a sizable empire in the east. However, by 120 BC, the Parthians, a people who lived in modern-day Iran and Iraq, had begun to make inroads into the empire. Then in 64 BC, Pompey annexed Syria, the last remaining territory in Seleucid possession, and the kingdom was eclipsed. The final chapter in the political struggle of the Greek world with the Romans occurred in the 30s BC, when Mark Antony allied himself to Cleopatra VII, Queen of Egypt. To a great extent, the Ptolemies had managed to avoid provoking the Romans in the 300 years of their existence. Largely, relations between the two peoples had been peaceful, and Rome had shown no desire to meddle in Egyptian affairs, unless it concerned her own interests. In 168 BC, as we have seen, Rome had come to the rescue of Egypt when Antiochus IV invaded the kingdom. It was Sulla who first seems to have turned covetous eyes on Egypt, though he was unable to influence affairs to any degree. By the time Ptolemy Auletes, the flute player, died in 51 BC, it was a recognized fact that the throne of Egypt was dependent for its survival on Rome. We tend to think of Cleopatra as a native Egyptian, but she wasn't. She was Greek, or at least half Greek. Whether she was as beautiful as Liz Taylor, who played her in the 1963 movie directed by Joseph L. Mankiewicz, we just don't know. We don't actually know who her mother was, but since the Ptolemies adopted the Egyptian practice of brother-sister marriage, the likelihood is that she was a Greek, like her father. Cleopatra became joint ruler of Egypt with her younger brother and husband, Ptolemy XIII, at age 18. She first drew the attention of the Roman world when she had a highly publicized sexual liaison with Julius Caesar when he arrived in Alexandria in 48 BC after defeating Pompey in the civil war. This excited the suspicion that she was aiming, through her liaison with Caesar, to establish a Hellenistic-style monarchy in, wait for it, Rome itself. What made it more plausible was the fact that she gave birth to a boy whom she named Ptolemy Caesar, pet name Caesarion. It's actually very unlikely that Caesar was the father. He was almost certainly infertile at this point, but it suited her purposes to claim that he was. And as we've noted before, one of the reasons why Caesar was so unpopular at the end of his life was because of the suspicions that he was aiming to have himself appointed king. When Caesar was assassinated, Cleopatra, ever the opportunist, transferred her affections and her political allegiance to Mark Antony, and those same fears of a Hellenistic monarch at Rome got recycled. Roman paranoia? Yes. Propaganda on Octavian's part? Definitely. The irony is that when Octavian took the title of Princeps in 27 BC and became, for all intents and purposes, an emperor, the constitutional model that he adopted borrowed much from the concept of Hellenistic monarchy. Before that happened, however, Octavian had to defeat Antony. And indeed, one of his principal weapons in that struggle for the hearts and minds of the Roman people was propaganda. No one in the history of Western civilization has better used propaganda to his advantage than Octavian. He made out that Cleopatra was a witch and seductress, and that Antony was a drunken debaucher. The final showdown came at the Battle of Actium, fought off the west coast of northern Greece in 31 BC. There are more than one versions of the naval battle, but so far as we can tell, when Cleopatra saw that the battle was going against Antony, she withdrew, and Antony gave up the struggle and meekly followed behind. Returning to Egypt, they separately committed suicide, and Egypt came under direct Roman rule. The last of the Hellenistic monarchies was now under the thumb of Rome. In the next lecture, we're going to be asking, why was it that the Romans won and the Greeks lost? It's a complex question that has no easy answer. It's all too easy to assume that the Romans were superior strategists, tacticians, and hand-to-hand fighters. But it was not only Greece's record on the battlefield that proved her undoing. It was also, as we shall see, her failure to take the measure of the Romans.